Welcome to the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX 935. Last week on my show, I talked about intuition, learning how to trust your gut. But there are times when that's unfair, when we can cause great injustice if we do that. So tonight, I'm going to talk about the times when our instincts don't serve us. And even though it's unlike me to get prescriptive, I'm going to offer some suggestions on how to quell those inner biases that are often so inculcated in our unconscious minds that we don't even know we're reacting in a biased, bigoted way. How about I start again with the eminent Nobel Prize-winning psychologist, economist, psychiatrist who guided us last week in the discussion of how and whether to trust those feelings deep in our gut. Is he just as attuned to the other side of the coin, times when our intuition might lead us astray, when we might be predisposed to treat certain people unequally? In his TED Talk, from which I'm going to be again quoting here, Daniel Kahneman talks to us about associative thought, and that's basically how we always think, whether automatically or strategically, we travel along paths of association. And to prove this, the power of even purely written words, he writes on a blackboard a word with negative associations. The word he writes is vomit. And it's amazing how much just reading such a word can affect us physiologically, as well as mentally and emotionally.
You couldn't help reading the word, so you had no control, of course. There were images that came to your mind, images and memories. Your body reacted, your pupils dilated, your heart quickened, you sweated a bit. You know, all of this has been confirmed. This is part of the reaction to this word. More than that, we could have measured your face and it twisted a bit in an expression of disgust. You recoiled. There is evidence that people's body, that their posture reacts and is different. We approach pleasant words, we recoil from unpleasant words. And then if we presented words in a whisper and asked you to recognize them, there is a whole set of words to which you are now unusually sensitive. Words like smell, stink, sick, nausea, all of these words, a whole cluster of words, you're now prepared to recognize more than you were before. This illustrates one of the basic mechanisms of System 1. That's the spreading of ideas in a network of associations. And the impressive aspect of all this complex of reactions that happen to you within a second or two is its coherence. This is not accidental. It all makes sense, your reaction to that single word. Now, the connections between the elements of this complex of reactions are not necessarily logical, but ideas that have been correlated in experience facilitate each other. This mechanism of coherence prepares you for things, and it evaluates surprises. Okay, this is a history class quiz. Write down the first three numbers of your home phone number. Add 400 to this number. Consider this total to represent a year in the common era. Do you believe that Attila the Hun was defeated in Europe before or after this year? And now, what is your best guess about the year of Attila the Hun's defeat in Europe? The people whose telephone numbers end with high digits end up with a high estimate of the year of the defeat of Attila the Hun. What is the mechanism here? It's associative coherence. Just having that number in mind causes you to bring together associations, whatever, that make this number more plausible. This is just part of the way our mind works. We are presented with information, we try to understand it. We don't try. System 1 tries to make sense of it by associative coherence. And so we end up with a different view of history depending on whether our telephone numbers end with a high number or with a small number. System 1 doesn't have much doubts. It makes choices. And it delivers to our conscious experience the choices that it has made, and we're not aware of having made the choice. Doubt and ambiguity is mostly a function of System 2.
Just to remind you, you're listening to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX 935. Following up on last week's discussion about instinct, questioning should we trust it, with a more nuanced examination of bias, because our instinct can lead us, albeit unwittingly, into bigotry and bias. So how to quell your inner bigot is the topic of my share in hour tonight. And I'm currently playing you part of a TED Talk of Daniel Kahneman's. He is an eminent Nobel Prize-winning economist, psychologist, and psychiatrist. And here he's explaining how the systems of our brains operate to inform our instincts and biases.
I can't help but tell you a story of how the system works. Some years ago, we were spending vacation on a resort island on the Barrier Reef next to Australia. It's a small resort. There are 40 rooms in that resort. And we went to dinner the first evening, and lo and behold, there was a psychologist I know who's at Stanford. And we were both really quite surprised. You know, fancy meeting you here. That sounded like a coincidence. And then 2 weeks later, we were in London going to the theater. And, you know, the theater was dark. Somebody sat next to me, and I didn't see who it was until the lights came up during the intermission, and it was the same person. And the thing I want to point out is I was less surprised the second time than the first, because what I computed immediately was, oh, that's Krosny. I meet him all over the place. I mean, the point is we create those associations very, very quickly. We're ready to form expectations very quickly. This is part of this associative mechanism, and sometimes it will work better than at other times. This associative machinery has incredible richness and subtlety. The feats of intuition that we see attest to the subtlety of our mental models. I mean, if I ask you who is more likely to play bridge and who is more likely to play poker, a Wall Street banker or an English professor, most of you know the answer. There is an answer in the culture. We would expect the Wall Street banker to play poker and the professor to play bridge. There's consensus on answers of this type. It's all part of the mental model. Through the network of associations widely shared within a culture, we can come up with answers to an infinite number of such questions in a blink of an eye, literally.
And therein lies our talent, but also our susceptibility to bias and bigotry. How to quell your inner bigot is the topic of my share in hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, with the help of a variety of experts, including the Nobel Prize-winning economist, psychologist, and psychiatrist Daniel Kahneman, from whom you just heard, talking about how quickly we make our assessments in the blink of an eye, referencing Malcolm Gladwell, who's written a book, Blink, The Power of Thinking Without Thinking. And I quoted from this book last week, and I'm going to be quoting from it again tonight with the story of the car salesman, just to show you how, though intuition can very often be helpful, so-called natural biases can also do us a great disservice. So this car salesman Malcolm Gladwell tells the story of is the king of car salesmen. He scores more sales in a year than any of his associates. And he gives us his reason for his success is he just follows a very simple rule. He says he may make a million snap judgments about a customer's needs and state of mind, but he tries never to judge anyone on the basis of his or her appearance. He assumes everyone who walks in the door has the exact same chance of buying the car they want. He says, quote, a green salesperson looks at a customer and says, this person looks like he can't afford a car. He says, that's the worst thing you can do, because sometimes the most unlikely person is flush. He says, I have a farmer I deal with to whom I've sold all kinds of cars over the years. We seal our deal with a handshake. He hands me a $100 bill and says, bring it out to my farm. You don't even have to write the order up. He says, now, if you saw this man with his coveralls and his cow dung, you'd figure he wasn't a real customer. But in fact, as we say in the trade, he's all cashed up. Sometimes people see a teenager and they blow him off. Well, later that night, the teenager comes back with mom and dad. They pick up the car, and it's the other salesperson that writes them up. And then there's racial prejudice. There was a social experiment conducted in the 1990s by a law professor in Chicago called Ian Ayres. He put together a team of 38 people. 18 were white men, 7 were white women, 8 were black women, 5 were black men. He took great pains to make them appear as similar as possible. All were in their mid-20s. all were of average attractiveness, all were told to dress in a conservative, casual manner, the women in blouses, straight skirts, flat shoes, the men in polo shirts or button-downs, slacks, loafers. All were given the same cover story, and they were told to go to a total of 242 car dealerships in the Chicago area and present themselves as college-educated young professionals, like, for instance, a systems analyst at a bank, living in the Tony Chicago neighborhood of Streeterville. Their instructions for what to do when they got there were even more specific. They were told to walk in, wait to be approached by a salesperson, then point to the lowest priced car in the showroom and say, "I'm interested in buying this car." Then, after they heard the salesman's initial offer, they were instructed to bargain back and forth until the salesman either accepted an offer or refused to bargain any further, a process that pretty consistently took about 40 minutes. What Ayres was trying to do was zero in on a very specific question. All other things being absolutely equal, how does skin color or gender affect the price that a salesman in a car dealership offers? And you probably know the answer if you are female or black, but the results were really quite stunning. The white men received initial offers from the salesman that were $725 above dealer's invoice. The white women got offers of $935 above invoice. Black women were quoted on average $1,195 above invoice. And black men, $1,687 on average above invoice. And even after they bargained, they could only, on average, get that $1,687 down to $1,551 above invoice. That's over double what the white man was offered at the very beginning, without even having to bargain. So what do we make of this? Are the car salesmen of Chicago incredible sexists and bigots? That's certainly the most extreme explanation for what happened. Gladwell writes in his book Blink that I'm quoting from here on tonight's KX935's The Sharoner. He notes that in the car salesman business, there's a huge predilection to try to spot the sucker. They even have a particular word for customers who pay the sticker price. They're called a laydown. But this doesn't make much sense of the way this particular sample were treated, because they weren't stupid, they weren't naive, they were all college-educated professionals who had high-profile jobs and lived in a wealthy neighborhood and were dressed well, dressed for success. They were all savvy enough to bargain for 40 minutes, so not suckers, any of them. Meaning that if Ayres' study is evidence of conscious discrimination, the car salesmen of Chicago are indeed outrageous bigots, or so stupid that they were oblivious to all those clues of affluence they were presented with. So Gladwell concludes that there was something more subtle going on, something like perhaps some car-selling law heard from other salesmen that there's a strong association between laydowns and women and minorities, and those concepts are linked in their mind unconsciously, so that when women and black people walk through the door, they instinctively think, sucker. Even though these salesmen would swear they were quoting the prices they were not on any racial or gender bias, but on a more sophisticated reading of their customers' character. But they'd already made these decisions by the time each customer walked through the door. It was unconscious. They were silently picking up on the most immediate, obvious things about these customers, their sex, and the color of their skin. And they were sticking with that judgment even in the face of all kinds of new contradictory evidence that went on during that 40 minutes. The star car salesman, the one who got all the customers, was more consciously aware. He knew that the farmer with the filthy coveralls could be an enormously rich man with a 4,000-acre spread, and that sometimes the teenager did return later with mum and dad, and that the young black student could have an MBA from Harvard, or that the petite blonde makes the car decisions for her whole family, and the man with the silver hair and broad shoulders is a lightweight. So he doesn't try to spot the laydown. He quotes everyone the same price, sacrificing high profit margins for the benefits of volume, And word of his fairness has spread so far that he gets up to a third of his business from referrals, from satisfied customers. He says, can I simply look at someone and say this person is going to buy a car? No, no way. Sometimes I get completely taken aback. Sometimes I'll have a guy come in waving a checkbook saying, I'm here to buy a car today. If the numbers are right, I'll buy a car today. And you know what? 9 times out of 10, he never buys. A similar kind of thing can happen in the workplace when we're either being hired or hiring someone. Often we have to go simply by the way people present themselves in an interview or on first days of working together. There's a tool that employers have used on the recommendation of psychologists. It's known as the IAT. The acronym is the Implicit Association Test. Psychologists are well aware that we make connections much more quickly between pairs of ideas that are already related in our minds than we do between pairs of ideas that are unfamiliar to us. And they conducted an actual test. They asked participants to put a sequence of names and words into two categories. Male or career was the first category. Female or family was the second category. That was quite straightforward. A lot of the words were names, female or male, Lisa, Matt. But other words were things like laundry, entrepreneur, merchant, capitalist, home, corporation, siblings, kitchen, housework, parents. And people did that pretty quickly. And then they asked them to put them into these two categories, either male/family or female/career. And the words were things like the more obvious ones, Derek, Sarah, John, Bob, Holly. And then there were words like merchant, employment, domestic, entrepreneur, office, home, corporation. And this time, it took a little longer to put, say, the word entrepreneur into the career category when career was paired with female than when career was paired with male. Because most of us still have stronger mental associations between maleness and career-oriented concepts than we do between femaleness and ideas related to career. For instance, male and capitalist go together in our minds, but when the word is merchant, we may stop and think, particularly when the category is male or family versus female or career. When psychologists administer this test, they usually do it on a computer, and the words are flashed on the screen one at a time, and you're asked to put in either the left-hand column in the example relating to male or family, or the right-hand column relating to female or career. Because this test is done on a computer, the responses are measurable down to a millisecond, so you can tell people's associations between men and women in the workforce. If you, listener, would like to try a computerized IAT, Implicit Association Test, you can go to www.implicit.harvard.edu, where you'll find the most famous of all the IATs, the RACE IAT. Malcolm Gladwell, whose book Blink, The Power of Thinking Without Thinking, I'm quoting from here on tonight's Cakes 935's The Sharon Hour, is himself of mixed race. He has a Jamaican mother, and he was a bit creeped out by this test because of his upbringing, thinks of the races as equal. But when he was asked to put the words hurt, evil, glorious, wonderful into either the European or bad column or the African-American or good column, he had to stop to think. And when he was asked to put those words into either the European-American or good column or African-American or bad column, he was quite mortified by the natural feelings of bias he had. Turned out that more than 80% of those who've ever taken the test have pro-white associations. So does this mean that we're all racist? Well, not exactly, but it does mean that our attitudes towards things like race or gender operate differently on a conscious level. What we choose to believe, what we tell ourselves to believe, our stated values, than on an unconscious level. The immediate automatic associations that tumble out before we've even had time to think. We may not even be aware of our prejudices. Worse, our unconscious attitudes may be completely incompatible with our stated conscious values. Gladwell says, for example, of the 50,000 African Americans who've taken this race IAT to date, about half of them have stronger associations with whites than with blacks. And he puts this down to living in North America, where we're surrounded every day by cultural messages linking white with good. And this is an important thing because the IAT, this implicit association test, isn't just an abstract measure of attitudes. It's also a predictor of how we act in certain spontaneous kinds of situations. If you have a strongly pro-white pattern of associations, for example, there's evidence that it'll affect the way you behave in the presence of a black person. It might not affect what you choose to say or feel or do. You probably won't be aware that you're behaving any differently than you would around a white person. But there's evidence that you'll lean forward a little less, turn away slightly from him or her, close your body off a little bit, be a little less expressive, maintain less eye contact, stand a little further away, smile a lot less, hesitate and stumble over your words a bit more, and laugh at jokes a bit less. So this matters hugely in a job interview, for instance. If the applicant's a black man and you're white, he's going to pick up on that uncertainty and distance, and that'll make him less certain of himself, less confident, a little less friendly. And you, if you're the white person, may well get a gut feeling that the applicant doesn't really have what it takes, or that he's a bit standoffish, or maybe doesn't really want the job. Or forget about race. What about if the person you're interviewing is tall? On a conscious level, we don't imagine that we treat tall people any differently from how we treat short people, unless they're extraordinarily tall or short. But there's a lot of evidence to suggest that height, particularly in men, does trigger a certain set of very positive unconscious associations. Gladwell polled about half of the companies on the Fortune 500 list. That's the list of the largest corporations in the US. Overwhelmingly, unsurprisingly, the heads of big companies are white men, but they're also almost all tall. On average, just under 6 feet tall, even though the average American male is 5'9". In the US, only about 14.5% of all men are 6 feet or taller. But among CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, that number's 58%. Even though in the general American population, only 3.9% of adult men are 6'2" or taller. So you can do the numbers, and we're not even getting into the lack of women or minorities among the top executive ranks. So if our prejudices are unconscious, what can we do about them? We could take the race IAT, the implicit association test, the one that pairs African-American with a negative, or the instinct that says women and black people who walk through the door of the car showroom are laydowns or suckers. But believe it or not, Gladwell says, there's evidence that if before you take that IAT, he asked you to look over a series of pictures or articles about people like Martin Luther King or Nelson Mandela or Colin Powell, your reactions might change, and you might suddenly be associating positive things with black people. He mentions that this actually happened to a student who took the IAT every day, with the idea of just letting the data gather. And one day, he got a positive association with blacks. And he thought, that's odd, that's never happened before. But he was a track and field guy, and he realized that he'd spent the morning watching the Olympics. So that's a way to change our, quote, natural biases, our first impressions, the way we thin slice. We can change the experiences that comprise those impressions. If you're white and want to treat black people as equal in every way, it takes more than a simple commitment to equality. It takes changing your life so that you're exposed to minorities on a regular basis and become comfortable and familiar with the best of their culture. So that when you want to meet or hire or date or talk with someone who's a minority, you're not hesitant or uncomfortable. We need to be aware of how much first impressions and prejudice play in our lives to change our attitudes so that they're not unconscious.
This is a song about prejudice and the language of prejudice and the power of the language of
prejudice. It's called prejudice.
Prejudice. Prejudice.
In our modern free-spoken society, there is a word that we still hold taboo. A word with a terrible history of being used to abuse, oppress and subdue. Just six seemingly harmless letters arranged in a way that will form a word with more power than the pieces of metal that are forged to make swords. A couple of G's, an R and an E, an I and an N. Just six little letters, all jumbled together, have caused damage that we may never mend. And it's important that we all respect that if these people should happen to choose to reclaim the word as their own, it doesn't mean the rest of you have a right to its use. So never underestimate the power that language imparts. Sticks and stones may break your bones, but words can break hearts. A couple of G's, cheese, unless you've had to live it. An R and an E, even I am careful with it. An I and an N, in the end it will only offend. Don't wanna have to spell it out again. Yeah. Only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. Only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. So listen to me, if you care for your health, you won't call me ginger unless you're ginger yourself. Yeah, only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. Yep. When you are a ginger, life is pretty hard. Years of ritual bullying in the schoolyard, kids call in your anger and fanny pants. No invitation to the high school dance, but you get up and learn to hold your head up. You try to keep your cool and not get head up, but until the feeling of ill is truly let up, then the word is ours and ours alone. Don't you know that only a ginger can call another ginger ginger? If only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. So if you call us ginge, we just might come unhinged. If you don't have a fringe with at least a tinge of the ginge in it, only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. Now listen to me, we're not looking for sympathy, just because we're sensitive to UV. Just cause we're pathetically pale, we do alright with the females. Yeah, I like to ask the ladies round for ginger beer, and soon they're running their fingers through my ginger beard and dunking my ginger nuts into their ginger tea, yeah. And asking, can they call me ginger? And I say, I don't think that's appropriate, because only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. Yeah. And all the ladies, they agree, it's a fact. Once you're gone, ginger, you can't go back. Only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. Yeah, go, ginger, go, you funky motherfucking. Bozo or fire truck.
Fire truck, fire truck.
You can even call us carrot top or blood nut.
Blood nut, blood nut.
Yeah, you can call us matchstick or tampon. But with the G word is just not on. If you're a gingerphobe and you don't like us, we will stand up to the fight if you want to fight us. But if you cut yourself, you might catch gingivitis. So maybe you should shut your funky mouth. Yeah, only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. Ginger can call another ginger ginger. See, if you call a ginger, you can't whinge. If you're injured, if you don't have a tinge of the ginger. binge and you minge. Only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. Yeah, and you know my kids will always be clothed and fed, 'cause Papa's gonna be bringing home the gingerbread. And they'll be pretty smart because they'll be well read. And by red I mean red, and the other kind of red, it's a homophone. Only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. Yeah, only a ginger can call another ginger ginger. Just like only a ninja can sneak up on another ninja. Yeah, only a ginger, only a ginger, only a ginger, yeah. Are you listening? I'm not pointing the finger, I'm just having a singer. I am just reminding ya that only a ginger can call another ginger ginger.
To Minton, demonstrating the power of words when it comes to prejudice. We have to be conscious of the words we use if we're trying not to be bigoted and biased, which is the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX 935. Consciousness of when we are conversing or behaving in a biased way is essential if we want to put the brakes on bigoted behavior. And there are ways that we can learn to do that. Ways to convert our biases from the more negative to the more positive. And we can do it in the same way as those biases are formed. By association. A lot of our biases are learned behavior rather than anything built in and natural. They're passed down from our culture, our parents, perhaps, or any number of other people that we're surrounded by, sometimes by choice, but often not. And what we call instinct can be simply a compilation of other people's prejudices being inculcated in us. Long-held ideas, particularly religious ones, can inform our automatic thinking, and it's only by retraining ourselves, being aware of those automatic reactions and automatic ways of thinking, that we can conquer so-called natural or atavistic bias. But it requires a lot of conscious mental effort, reading things we might not have been exposed to before, choosing the particular people we surround ourselves with, informed, thoughtful people, speaking, writing in different ways, because words carry a lot of weight. Words, as much as actions, can affect our subconscious or unconscious intuitions, particularly word associations. So what we absorb from books and television and audio or visual media is important in terms of our bias and conquering bigotry. Otherwise, our default position will just be guided by our subconscious. Psychologist Daniel Kahneman stresses how important these word associations are.
What we find is that in the system which is associatively coherent, the way that you describe outcomes and the way that you describe problems is going to make a great deal of difference to how people respond to them. So it makes a difference whether you say that during the first month after surgery, there is 10% mortality, or that survival rate after 1 month is 90%. The first description is more frightening than the second description because the word mortality is there and the word survival is in the other. And when you have that, indeed, experienced physicians will make different choices between surgery and radiation therapy, depending on which of these formulations is adopted. We have no control over that. In the early days of behavioral economics, it was still legal to have two prices at the gas station, a different price for cash and for credit. And you could describe that either as a cash discount or as a credit card surcharge. Now, obviously, one of these descriptions is much more favorable to credit cards than the other. A cash discount we can forego, a surcharge we hate. So in that sense, the theory of the rational agent, you know, in the argument that psychologists have had with economists, is a non-starter. It really does not recognize the way that System 1 operates. We're enormously suggestible, and we can be manipulated to quite a remarkable degree.
So then a lot of our biases come from associations with other people's experience, or maybe not even experience, just perceptions. What we're shown, we see portrayed in books or on TV or in movies associated with certain events, or in the case of depictions of people, can lead to unnecessary bias and prejudice. You are tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX 935. My topic tonight is how to quell your inner bigot. And I'm quoting from psychologist and psychiatrist Daniel Kahneman, as well as from Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink, Power of Thinking Without Thinking. He mentions the psychologist Jonathan Schuller, who I've also interviewed in the past. He pioneered research into what he called verbal overshadowing. Your brain has the two parts, what we call the left brain, the left hemisphere, which is the analytical part that thinks in words, and the right brain, the hemisphere we call the creative side of the brain, that thinks in pictures. So what happens when you describe someone's face in words is that your actual visual memory gets displaced, overshadowed, as it were. Your thinking gets bumped from the right creative side to the left analytical side. So you're referring to a description when you're faced with a lineup and talking about how you recognize somebody, your memory goes to the analytical descriptive side rather than what you actually saw, which can be a problem because we're much better at visual recognition than we are at verbal description. Gladwell gives the example of if he were to show you a picture of Marilyn Monroe or Albert Einstein, you'd instantly recognize them as who they were by the picture in front of you, the picture you've probably got in your mind now the minute I say those two names. But if you had to describe them to somebody in a paragraph written down without saying who their names were, that would be a whole other deal, right? Far less instinctive, far less evocative. It's like that old puzzle. A man and his son are in a serious car accident. The father's killed. The son's rushed to the emergency room. Upon arrival, the attending doctor looks at the child and says, "I can't treat this child. This is my son." And we're asked, who then is the doctor? Even today, in our minds, the doctor is a man, so we don't realize the doctor is the mother. But it isn't a logic problem. It's an instinct problem. We need to make a leap beyond the assumption we already hold in our memory that a doctor, particularly a surgeon, is a male. Of course, intellectually, when we have the time, we don't think like that. It's only when the right brain picture quickly pops into our mind. Sometimes when we're asked to explain ourselves, particularly in writing, we get a kind of paralysis by analysis. The decision-making expert, Gary Klein, from whose TED talk on how we're affected by instinct I'm going to play you in a minute here on tonight's KX935's The Sharon Hour, once did an interview with the commander of a fire department in Cleveland. It was part of a project to get professionals to talk about times when they had to make tough split-second decisions. And the fireman told of what seemed like a routine call he'd taken years before, when he was a lieutenant. He said the fire was in the back of a one-story house in a residential neighborhood. It was in the kitchen. The lieutenant, and his men broke down the front door and, as firemen say, charged the line with their hose, dousing the flames in the kitchen with water. He said at that point, the fire should have abated, but it didn't. So the men sprayed again, and still it didn't make much of a difference. The fireman backed through the kitchen archway into the living room, and here the lieutenant thought, there's something very wrong. He screamed, "We need to get out now." And moments after they did, the floor on which they'd been standing collapsed, because it turned out the fire had been in the basement. And of course, heat rises. According to Klein, the lieutenant thought it was ESP. He really didn't know why he'd ordered everyone out. But Klein wasn't about to accept ESP as an answer. So for a couple of hours, he interrogated the fireman to try to get to the basis of what he really did and didn't know. Klein says the first thing was that the fire hadn't behaved in the way it was supposed to. Kitchen fires should respond to water, and this one didn't. When they backed into the living room, the fireman was surprised at how hot this fire still felt. The kitchen fire shouldn't have been that hot. Klein pressed him even further, and the fireman said, The other thing he realized that was surprising was that the fire wasn't noisy, and it didn't make sense that it was that quiet given how much heat there was. In retrospect, all those anomalies made sense. The fire didn't respond to being sprayed in the kitchen because it wasn't centered in the kitchen, and it was quiet because it was muffled by the floor. The living room was hot because the fire was actually directly underneath the living room. But at the time, the firemen made none of those connections consciously. They were all unconscious, thin slicing in action, making a pattern out of chaos. Had the lieutenant stopped and discussed the situation with his men before he screamed, "Let's get out," had he tried to talk it over or figure out what was going on in words, they might never have gotten out and saved their lives. Here to give us more insight on all of this, from said TED Talk, brought to you now on this, the Sharon Hour on Lagunas Cakes 935, is Gary Klein himself.
I'm a cognitive psychologist. I study how people make tough decisions under time pressure and uncertainty. Historically, decision researchers look at the kinds of errors and biases that people make that get in the way of good decisions. My research is just the opposite. I look at our strengths. I look at the ways we can use our experience. You've got to reduce errors, no doubt about that. But that's not enough. People would say, my organization, that's all they care about, cutting mistakes. But you don't want to go home at night and say, I had a great day. I didn't make any mistakes. You're hoping for more than that. You want to increase your achievements, your accomplishments. You want to have more insights. Where do insights come from? People would say, what can you tell us about that? And I'd say, I don't have any idea. And they didn't find that a very satisfying answer, and I didn't find that a very satisfying answer. So it was time to try to find out where insights come from. Insights are unexpected discoveries about how things work and how to make them work better. Wilbur Wright, discovering that if he could change the angle of the wings on his flying machine while it was flying, he and Orville could change directions and swoop through the air like birds. Those are the kinds of insights that I have in mind, as well as many minor insights that happen to us all the time. Insights are unexpected, they come without warning, but they've got to come from somewhere. So I decided to try to see if I could figure out where they came from. I put together a sample of 120 insights. I collected them from magazine articles, I collected them from books, from old interviews I had done with experts in different domains. And I tried to find a single common theme that would explain insight. And I failed. I couldn't come up with one theme. Instead, I came up with three different pathways. One of the pathways was when we try to solve something, try to achieve a goal, and we hit a block, an impasse, and we don't know how we can get out of it. And then if we're lucky, all of a sudden it dawns on us, here's the answer. I'll give you an example.
Here, Gary Klein holds up one of those join the dots puzzles.
9-dot problem. Task is connect the 9 dots using 4 lines without ever lifting your pen from the paper. This is a very hard problem. If I gave you a half hour, most of you wouldn't be able to solve it. Some of you would. Some of you would realize what the answer was. Of course, the answer is pretty straightforward. There's a way to solve it. So what stops us? What gets in our way? Well, for this kind of an impasse problem, this pathway, we make unnecessary assumptions that trap us. We assume that we're supposed to keep the lines within the boundaries. That's not a requirement. And we assume we can only change direction of the lines on a dot, and that's not a requirement. So we make unnecessary assumptions that get in our way. Some researchers have noticed that and said, let's come up with critical thinking exercises to overcome this problem with unnecessary assumptions. Let's have you, when you start a project, list all the assumptions that you're making. And it sounds reasonable. But it's not, because the assumptions that we're making with the 9-dot problem, they're unconscious assumptions. We're not even aware that we're making them. And it's very hard to write down unconscious assumptions.
But it is very often those unconscious assumptions that turn us into bigots without thinking that we are or meaning to be. How to quell our inner bigot is the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX 935. You're currently listening to psychologist Gary Klein talk about how and why we form our assumptions and maybe how we can change them, gain a little more insight.
The first pathway to insight is about creative desperation. You're stuck and you're trying to figure out some creative way to reach an insight. So this is the first pathway. The second pathway is about connections, seeing that pieces work together. Simple example, Charles Darwin in the 1830s collects all kinds of examples from different species, and he's wondering, where did these variations come from? And what keeps them going? Why do some keep going and others don't? And then one day he reads a book by Malthus about population growth and competition for scarce resources. And Darwin thinks, that's it. Survival of the fittest. That's the engine that drives this process of species variation. And he has his theory of evolution. So he's putting different ideas together to form a new model, a new idea. Some people look at that and say, okay, so this is all about connecting the dots. I hate the metaphor of connecting the dots. It trivializes what we do. It makes it sound like we're in kindergarten. This dot and that dot and, oh, it's a bunny, and that's all there is to it. What it misses is the front part. Okay, so is this a dot or is it a smudge? And this could be a dot, but I'm not sure it's related to the... In other words, there's a lot of noise at the beginning that you have to sort through. And if you eliminate the noise and just leave the actual dots, in hindsight, it looks like you're connecting the dots, but that's not what you're doing. So this is the second path. Third path that I found is about contradictions, where you see the pieces don't fit together. I'll give you an example. A police officer sitting in his car, waiting for the light to turn. Car in front of him is a brand new BMW. Officer watches the driver take a drag on a cigarette, flick the ashes. And the officer thinks, who flicks the ashes in your brand new BMW? Or if you borrow from your friend, would you do that? This doesn't seem to make sense. Lights him up, pulls him over. Sure enough, it's a stolen car. So now I think you can see why I couldn't come up with one pathway. The connection path is how we put ideas together. The contradiction path is seeing that ideas don't fit together. The creative desperation path, you're looking for a belief or an assumption that you can get rid of. The connection path, you're looking to add a new belief that will give you a richer notion. The creative desperation path is all inside. What beliefs do I have that are getting in my way? The contradiction path is outside. What am I seeing that doesn't make sense with everything that I know? So these three paths seem to work in their own dynamic. And so now, when people ask me, where do insights come from, I can point to that model and say, this is what gives rise to insights.
You're listening to part of a TED Talk by psychologist Gary Klein on insights. Okay, you might say, but I'm tuned to KX935's The Sharon Hour, and the show is supposed to be how to quell your inner bigot. So where does all this stuff on insight fit in? Well, we're getting there.
So we see where insights come from. How can we get more insights, people? What advice can you give us about making more discoveries and gaining more insights? And again, I wasn't expecting that question. I had no idea, but they seemed keen on trying to come up with some advice. So I decided I would give it a shot. So what I did was I went into my sample of 120 insights to see if there was any clue that I could use. This time, though, I wasn't looking for a common path, because a common path in this situation wouldn't really help us very much. Let's say, and this is really trivial, let's say I found everybody in my sample had cereal with their breakfast. Could I say, here, I've solved the problem. This is what you need to do, have cereal with your breakfast. No, because there are a lot of people who have cereal with their breakfast and go on to have no insights at all for the next several hours. Not going to work. So instead, I went through the 120 insights, and I found a group of 30 where there was a comparison. And the 30 cases had one person who had the insight, a real person, and a second person, also a real person, who had all the same information and didn't come up with the insight. So now I had a natural comparison, and I could see what distinguished between the two of them. And what I found was, the person who had the insight had an active, curious mindset. They were wondering about things. unexpected things, unusual things. They enjoyed playing with ideas. They enjoyed speculating. That was just the way their head worked. People who didn't have the insight were very heads down. Let's get the job done. Don't bother me with distractions. Keep everything simple. Don't give me some new hypothetical ideas that might not work. A novel idea, good chance it's going to fail. Let's stick to the game plan. So that was the difference between the two groups. Based on that difference, I think I may have an idea for how you can increase insights. And I haven't tested it. This is pure speculation. But you might want to try it. The idea is simply to try to get yourself into the mindset, into the frame of thinking of having an active, curious mindset about the things that occur around you rather than go about your work mindlessly following the routines. It's a mindset that seems as if it might promote insights. How can you do this? I have four suggestions. First suggestion, make insights a habit, part of your repertoire. When we miss a connection, we kick ourselves. Why didn't I notice that? Or if there's an anomaly and we don't pick it up until it's too late, what an idiot we are. And we're critical of ourselves. But even at that time, we've made discoveries. We're smarter than we were before. Give yourself credit for, even in hindsight, having the insight. And also, there are times when you do notice connections in time. You do spot anomalies that change your behavior. So you are having insights, but you don't notice them. We tend to just shrug them off, not give them much attention. Well, notice them. Celebrate them. That's how to make them part of your repertoire. Some people have suggested maybe you should keep a log of your insights. And I think that would be fun. I think it would be informative. But most of you aren't going to keep logs. I know that. But you can at least notice and appreciate the insights that you have more than you're currently doing. Second thing you can do is use your curiosity. What should you be curious about? Anything that comes up that's unusual or unexpected or catches your attention, instead of saying, I'm too busy, give it a few seconds and wonder about it. You could be curious about the assumptions you're making. Are they really important? Do you need all of them? Maybe you should re-examine them. You could be curious about coincidences. Instead of saying, that's just a mere coincidence, maybe it is. But sometimes coincidences put us on the road to connections. So give it some thought. What's going on underneath there? Contradictions, anomalies. Most of them are just irrelevant and you explain them away. But then you don't get any insights. And so you see an anomaly. Sometimes you may want to spend a few seconds. What is that anomaly telling us? That guy who flicked his ashes in his new BMW. What's that all about? And give it a few seconds thought about what might be happening. The idea here is to try to use your curiosity more effectively. The third step is to try to encourage other people and get them to generate insights. And there's ways of doing that. Ask them what surprised you since the last time we talked. And if they say, nothing surprised me, everything is fine, you don't have to worry, that's when you need to worry. The fourth step is irritations, confusions, and contradictions and conflicts, the things that irritate us. They irritate us, but we can still use them. I'll give you an example. I was once putting on a seminar on leadership and the difficulty of explaining vision. And one person in the seminar said, I know just what you mean. I had somebody, I brought him into my office, I gave him a task, he understood it, out he went, brought him back a few days later, he went in the wrong direction. I totally missed it up. And I said, before you sent him out, did you ask him, what did you think I wanted? And he said, no, why would I do that? Why would you do that? You might learn something. Maybe he had a bad idea, or maybe your instructions weren't as clear and he had a valid interpretation, even if it wasn't the one you wanted. And so the idea here is to try to take on this active, curious mindset that might bring you into a world of possibilities.
Well, then maybe the best way to change our bias, the topic of my KX935's The Sharon Hour tonight, is to realize that what we think isn't necessarily what we actually do think. And this was demonstrated in an experiment done by a psychologist called Sheena Iyengar. She is somebody actually I interviewed and used on a former Sharon now years ago. She's a professor at Columbia and a rather fascinating woman. And she and a colleague, Raymond Fisman, did a speed dating experiment to discover whether we make our choices consciously or unconsciously, especially in emotional areas when it comes to love and its precursor, dating. The experiment was to compare what speed daters said they wanted with what they're actually attracted to in the moment. And of course, they discovered those things don't necessarily match. Probably don't match. For instance, when this one woman we'll call Mary says she only wants intelligent, sincere men, that doesn't mean she'll be attracted only to the intelligent and sincere men. In the speed dating exercise, it turned out that Mary ended up liking the more attractive, funny men than the smart and sincere ones. And actually, the next day, after being asked to describe her perfect man, she suddenly said she likes attractive and funny men. But that's just immediately after. A month later, she's back to saying she wants intelligent, sincere men. So what does she really want? Which is real, the person she describes herself to be or the person she actually reveals herself to be? An economist, says Fisman, would say the real you is the you revealed by your actions. Psychologist Sheena Iyengar says, I'm not sure that's what a psychologist would say. That's because there really isn't a single right answer. One is Mary's conscious ideal, what she believes she wants. The actual criteria she uses for who she's attracted to can be behind the locked door of her subconscious. The funny thing is, people may be ignorant of the things that affect their actions and emotions, but they're rarely aware that they're ignorant. Those are the sort of things that lie in the subconscious or the completely unconscious mind. So, listener, have we found ways in which we can quell our inner bigot? That being the topic of tonight's KX935's The Sharer Now. We've learnt that a lot of our biases are from associations, but we've also learnt we have different pathways in the brain. We have the connection pathway that makes sense of the associations, but we also have the contradiction path that sees the anomalies. If we're curious individuals that want to go a little deeper, we can also tap into the contradiction paths rather than blindly following our shallower instincts. Whether or not to trust our instincts, which I discussed in my last week's Sharon Hour, or whether we follow the pathways that see anomalies and thereby learn how to not be so biased, is for each of us to contemplate. The latter takes a little bit more effort, requiring curiosity and research into things. So that's it for my Sharer Now tonight. If you want to hear the show again, you can do so on iTunes or go to kx935.com/shows/the-sharon-hour. That's sharing without the G, hour with the H. And do come back and listen to this show again. Live, if you live in Laguna Beach, it's on Monday nights at 9. And if you are tuned in live, realize that even though you might have Alerto C or Nixie on your phone, we do give emergency alerts and let you know what's going on locally throughout the day. So turn your dial to KX935 on a regular basis and do become a member of our KX935 FM radio station. We love and we need your support. Meantime, this is Sharon James, wishing a great week ahead.